What is going on, everybody? Penn Station Sports Talk is back. It is episode number five. We're already at number five. It seems like the time is flying. As always, I am with my favorite co-host, Justin. It is a nice Tuesday night. There's some breaking news that we're going to get into. The Mets are red hot. They just beat the Yankees. A lot to get to. The Stanley Cup is over. But before we get into any sports, Justin, how are you doing, my friend?
Oh, I'm doing great. I'm doing fantastic on this Tuesday, and I'm glad you're still your favorite co-host as
Hasn't
every
changed.
hopefully it won't change for episode six either.
Well,
But
you seem very giddy. And you seem
I
like you're in a
am.
very good mood. So, Justin,
I
I
am.
there is some breaking news that just occurred about 10, 15 minutes ago on this Tuesday night when we are recording. So, Justin, what's got you so joyful on this Tuesday night?
Well, about half an hour before we started recording, the first big trade in the NBA offseason just occurred. The New York Knicks sent four unprotected first round picks. So they're 2025, 2027, 2029, and 2031 first rounders, and a 2025 protected first rounder and a 2028 unprotected pick swap and a 2025 second rounder. So basically, like every single pick that you can imagine.
No, there's no more picks. I thought you were going to say another
No,
one.
that
Oh,
that was it. That was
okay.
it.
And not nothing not
So
too crazy, just eight picks or however that was.
they pretty much sent the kitchen sink for Mikal Bridges, the star on the Brooklyn Nets, Villanova guy on the championship team with Dante DiVincenzo, Josh Hart, and Jalen Brunson. He's like, as some people are saying it, the last Infinity Stone that the Knicks needed. I wonder where Chris Jenkins is. Maybe they could get him to fill out the roster. The guy who hit the game-winning shot for Villanova in the finals to win them March Madness that year. But a super exciting trade. Knicks fans, analysts, they've kind of been speculating about this type of trade for I would say for about a year or so even now, maybe like 8, 10 months. But the Knicks and Nets, they haven't made a trade since 1983. So it's been
41 years.
a very long time since then they've made a trade. So I mean, as much as I wanted Mikal Bridges, I not didn't know if the Nets would trade him to the Knicks, but reports are that Mikal Bridges asked out of Brooklyn and demanded to be traded to the New York Knicks, and if the Nets did not trade him, he was going to go public with his desire to go to the Knicks, which would have tanked his trade value. So a massive, massive trade for the Knicks. Jay, I'll let you step in if you have any comments. I don't want to go on
I
too
do.
much, but
I do. I have a couple comments.
yeah.
I always find it interesting. So for me, the way I've seen it in baseball, the Mets and Yankees never make trades, and they've never made any blockbuster trades. They don't. Football, there isn't any trades anyway, so I'm gonna throw that out of the way. In hockey, the Rangers don't trade with the Islanders or the Devils. And I didn't really know that in basketball, it was the same sort of thing where the Knicks and Nets didn't make significant trades with each other. But what I find interesting is how much leverage Mikal Bridges had in this deal. Because like you just told me, he basically told the Nets, hey, I want out. And what I have to ask you is, did he really say he wanted to go to the Knicks, or he just said he wanted to be traded?
He said he wanted to go to the Knicks, like
Mm. Well,
specifically
he sees an opportunity.
because he wanted to play with his three best friends from Villanova,
Brunson and
Brunson, Hart,
yeah.
and DiVincenzo, and he wanted to go to the Knicks. But it's the same. It's a crosstown rivalry, heated rival. I would say that as a Knicks fan, the biggest rivals for the Knicks are the Boston Celtics and the Brooklyn Nets. Those are like the, at least for me, like personally, and I would say for most Knicks fans, those would be the two most hated teams currently. So it's the same thing if like, you know, the Giants and the Eagles made a big like trade, or the Giants and Cowboys made a big trade.
Oh, that just sounds weird.
It would be like it's the same as if like the Red Sox and the Yankees like made a big trade kind of thing. It's like that kind of equivalent of a deal. Now, it's not, I wouldn't say the Nets-Knicks rivalry is anywhere close to the Red Sox and Yankees rivalry in historical terms, but it's like a, you know, a divisional rivalry and a cross-town rivalry.
Yeah.
So it's like double
the importance,
yeah, double the importance. So the Nets, unless they absolutely had to, would not have wanted to trade Mikal Bridges to the Knicks.
So what I have to ask now, and I'm sure this is going to be the question of the of this next few months until the season starts and throughout the season, does this move make them a legit contender? Because, you know, I'm not to put the damper on it, I'm not a basketball person. I don't know ball. I do not know ball when it comes to basketball. But I'm looking at his basketball reference page. He's never been an all-star before. He's a good defensive player from what it looks like. He plays every day. He's played 82 games at least the last three seasons. So that being said, is he good enough to bring it? Like, is he going to complete, like you said, the Infinity Stone analogy? Is he going to complete this Knicks roster to bring them to a place of contention?
Well, I'll give you a two-part answer. So the first part is what Mikal Bridges brings to the Knicks. And then the second part is what the Knicks now need to do.
All right.
In the draft and free agency.
All right.
So, well, Mikal Bridges, he hasn't been an all-star. But he is a very good player. His best ability is his durability. He has played in 434 consecutive games, and he has not missed an NBA game in his entire career. So
wow.
He has played in every single... Now, a side note, he's eaten Chipotle, he claims, every single day of his NBA career. So I don't know if there's a correlation between the two or what, but he has not missed a single game. So, you know, he's like one of those players that's a low level, like all-star, like upper tier, like starter type of player. He also, up until coming to the Nets, he was never the best player, on his team. Mm-hmm. So he wasn't getting like, you know, he didn't have the highest usage rate. I mean, this past year, he was, you know, the star on the team. So this was the first time that he was like the guy, and he performed well. He averaged 20 points a game. He shot like 37%, I think, from 3-point range. He's a very good defensive player. He's a very good team player. You know, he can get hot in a hurry. When he's the type of guy that, like, you know, if he's your number one player on your team, you know, he's not like Kevin Durant or LeBron James or Jokic or someone like that, but he's a really good high level starter that can contribute. And he fits in perfectly with the Knicks because he's going to have very good chemistry with these other Villanova guys. And the Knicks, this past year, they had a lot of trouble with durability on their roster. It cost them in the playoffs. It's part of what run them down so much in the regular season. And getting a guy who, knock on wood, based on his track record, at least, hasn't even missed a game. So you're banking on a guy who's going to be out there for pretty much all 82 games, which is something that the Knicks with Julius Randle the past two seasons with OG Anunoby this past year with Mitchell Robinson, you haven't been able to really guarantee. So having a high-level starter out there is going to be really important. So he brings a lot of intangibles to the Knicks, and he brings a lot of scoring ability as well. So he should be able to help out there. So that's kind of what Mikal Bridges brings to the Knicks. What they need to do now, though, they have OG Anunoby, who's a free agent. He's going to be very high in demand. And then they have Isaiah Hartenstein, who is very high in demand, who is their starting center. And then the Knicks have two first-round picks still tomorrow.
After all that, they still have two picks.
After all that, they still have two first-round picks. And
for Leon Rose, it's good, good GM masterclass, if you will.
It really is. They have two first rounders and pick 38, yeah. So a high second rounder. The value, though, obviously, of NBA picks as you go down the board outside the lottery significantly decreases. But still, the Knicks have picks 24, 25, and 38 tomorrow in the draft. So I think the Knicks, they can't just let this can't be, a trade. Like, you get Mikal Bridges and you let OG walk, because it's basically like an equivalent. You're not really gaining in any aspect there. I think, the Knicks, they traded RJ Barrett. They traded Emmanuel Quickly for OG Anunoby in that big trade in the middle of the season. And I can't imagine that they made that trade without having some sort of deal in mind with OG. And OG Anunoby's agent, I don't know if you knew this, Jay, OG's agent is the Knicks president, Leon Rose's son.
It's a dumb deal then.
So
the deal's done. He's in Knicks. And what are we even talking about then?
So
dumb deal.
You would assume that they should be able to get a deal done. And now I do think the Knicks might have to pay more than they would like, or that maybe we would expect, because other teams will obviously be very interested in OG, but I think the Knicks, they need to get that deal done with OG. Then their center situation is what becomes a little bit more interesting. I don't think you can afford to pay both Mitchell Robinson and Isaiah Hartenstein. Hartenstein's also a free agent this year. And the Knicks, there's a maximum amount that they're able to pay him. I believe it's 4 years, $78 million. But other teams in free agency are able to offer him more. It's just kind of how it works with, like, the contracts and stuff. And we won't get into all that, the details, but that's kind of how it works in the NBA. So if they're, I think I would prefer to keep Hartenstein, because he has a little bit more offensive potential than Robinson, and he's been significantly more durable. It's kind of, though, on the Knicks, they'll have the most information on whether they think they can retain, if they retain Hartenstein. I think if they can retain Hartenstein, we might see them trade away Robinson, Mitchell Robinson, tomorrow night during the draft. I would not be surprised about. If they don't trade away Robinson, maybe they think they can sign Hartenstein, but I doubt they're going to be able to keep both of the two. I would expect the Knicks to draft a center tomorrow night. That would be definitely the number one need, I think, that they currently have. Even if they still had Robinson and Hartenstein, they do need a third center for their team. But I think if I were the Knicks, I would re-sign Hartenstein and trade away Mitchell Robinson for a good shooting bench piece, and then draft a center tomorrow night. Maybe they could even package those two first-round picks and the second-round pickup and trade up into the lottery and get Zach Edey from Purdue. That would be a very exciting trade.
I've heard of it. He was cooking in March Madness, I remember.
He won the equivalent of the MVP of college basketball.
The Heisman, basically.
The Heisman. So I would say if I were the Knicks,
they could package those two picks on, like, Mitchell Robinson, and there you go.
Right. And Or they can try and get a guy, this guy from the Wizards, Danny Avdija. He was a high first round pick a few years ago, has a lot of potential, hasn't panned out. Like, he hasn't been a superstar as what kind of was expected, but he would be a great bench piece for the team too. And the Wizards and the Knicks have been talking about a trade regarding Mitchell Robinson. So that could be a way for the Knicks to clear some salary. But if I were my future plan for the Knicks, I would re-sign OG Anunoby, re-sign Isaiah Hartenstein, trade away Mitchell Robinson for a good shooting bench piece, and then draft 1 to 2 centers in the draft. Maybe sign some low-level center free agents. So that would kind of be my plan for the Knicks going forward, but we'll see what they're able to do. It'll be very exciting to see what they do tomorrow night. I would be shocked. I would be very surprised if they did not make a trade of some sort tomorrow.
Leon Rose, who? I got the GM of the Knicks right here, Justin Marchand. So what I'm hearing is Leon Rose has been a busy man, and if they don't sign OG, Thanksgiving dinner will be sort of awkward at the Rose house.
I would say so, because if they traded away RJ Barrett and Emmanuel Quickly for OG, and to only have him for half a season where he only played half the games would not be a good trade for the Knicks. So I would imagine they re-sign him. There are a lot of other great players that are on the market are going to kind of set the tone as well. Paul George is free agent. LeBron James, it could be a free agent if he opts out of his contract. James Harden's a free agent.
Those are all, wow.
Tyrese Maxey.
All big names. You know?
Yeah, there's a ton of big names on that will be on the market. And then there's, you know, a lot of guys who could get traded, like Kevin Durant has come up in a lot of trade talks, potentially being traded to the Rockets. There's been some rumors. Jimmy Butler could be traded away from the Heat. There's a lot. Brandon Ingram's been a popular name from the Pelicans. So there's a lot of big trades that could be cooking up. There's a lot of big free agents. So in this free agency, a lot of these top free agents re-sign, there won't be a lot of changes, but there could be, the building of some new super teams, depending on what occurs. So we'll see what happens, but all starts tomorrow night with the draft.
Yeah, well, so we'll see what the Knicks do in the draft. We'll monitor free agency, which starts on Sunday. So the next episode we do will be next week, and by then, maybe we'll have some more trades and more free agency signings to talk about. We could spend the whole episode talking about if LeBron James will opt out and what the Knicks should do and where we think where possible destinations are. But we will save all of that for next week, and we'll see what comes to fruition there. So, Justin, I think we should move on to hockey now. Before we start talking about the NHL, we have a very, very, very exciting announcement. We are introducing a brand new spin-off show of Penn Station, and it will be Penn Station Hockey. So it is under the same umbrella as Penn Station Sports Talk, but it is a separate show. A couple of my very good friends who are huge hockey fans will be having their own podcast that is, again, under the Penn Station umbrella name. It will be all centered around hockey, and with the Stanley Cup ending, which we'll talk about in a second, and with free agency starting and the offseason coming to a beginning, they will have all the coverage of free agents and who might be traded and the ramifications of the Stanley Cup and everything like that. So we are excited to announce that. So make sure to check that out. It is going to be released sometime this week. The name is still in the works, but some sort of iteration of Penn Station Hockey. Very exciting. It's going to be a lot of good insight there. Make sure to check that out as well. And yeah, we just wanted to let everyone know. So now that we have mentioned that, we'll talk about what happened. And what happened was the Florida Panthers won the Stanley Cup. They won in seven games. The last time we did a show was last Tuesday, a week ago. And by then, the Oilers were down 3-1. And everyone thought, okay, whatever, the Panthers will just win. But the Edmonton Oilers then won two more games, one more in Florida, one in Edmonton at home, and then they sent it back to Florida for a game seven where the Panthers were up 3-0. And the Panthers were on the verge of becoming the first team in 82 years to blow a 3-0 lead in the Stanley Cup. And it would have been an all-time embarrassment for them. And it would have been an all-time triumph for the Oilers. And it would have solidified Connor McDavid as maybe not even just an all-time great, but the GOAT. It would have really solidified that. But even though the Florida Panthers won the cup, interestingly, Connor McDavid won the Conn Smythe Award, which is the playoffs MVP, on the losing team, which is something you do not see often. The last time that a Conn Smythe winner was on the losing team for the Stanley Cup was 2003. Jean Sebastian Jarre in 2003, the goalie for the Anaheim Ducks, won. And I didn't even know this, Justin. I did some research because I had to see, like, if you're going to win that on the losing team, you have to be another level of great. And by the way, Connor McDavid set the assists record for single playoffs with 34 assists. He had 42 points in 25 games, which is basically, if you want to extrapolate that number across a whole season, that's like 150 points for an entire 82-game season. So he was on a heater in this postseason. And it's amazing that he was able to carry them this far. He was a big part of the reason why they even got to a game seven. But just for reference, Jean Sebastian Jarre in 2003. He was a goalie for the Anaheim Ducks. The Ducks like snuck into the postseason that year. And in the Western Conference Finals that year, the Ducks played the Minnesota Wild. They swept them. He had a shutout in the first three games, three straight shutouts, and then he gave up one goal in game four. So across four games, he allowed one goal on 123 shots.
Wow.
In game one, it went to double overtime, and they won, and then he got the shutout. Game two, another shutout. Game three, another shutout. And then game four, he gave up one goal on 123 shots for the series. That I think might be like the greatest performance. You can't be better than that. Like
four games, like
he gave up the one goal, but I'm saying like that is unheard. Three straight shutouts.
Crazy. That's crazy.
So that makes sense why he won. That makes sense why he won the Conn Smythe, even though he was on the losing team. But McDavid was great. However, I have to critique where critiques are due. He was a bit invincible. So was Draisaitl in game seven. And McDavid had an opportunity in this game. I don't know if you are going to remember the play, but it was late in the third period and he got a pass and he was in front of the net. I wouldn't say he was wide open because there were Panther defenders near him, but he had a chance in front of the net one-on-one with Bobrovsky and he did not put it in the net. And I feel like as this monster player, as this larger than life player that he is, you have to score in that situation. I'm not going to ridicule him too much. He's an all-time great already. And when it's all said and done, could be the greatest to ever play. He'll get a Stanley Cup eventually, I do believe. And he was fantastic in this playoffs. But I think it's worth noting that he was a bit invincible in this game seven.
Well, invisible, I think.
Oh, invisible, not invincible. Late at night, I'm tired. Invisible, yeah.
But, you know, I know exactly the play you're referencing. He had a couple other really good opportunities in that late in that third period to put the puck in the net. They, you know, they gave him every chance to do it. They were so close to scoring on many occasions. When before the Panthers scored their second goal, the Oilers were like 2 or 3 inches from scoring their own goal. And taking a 2-1 lead. So that play and that like 30 seconds in the second period ended up being the difference between winning and losing. Connor, I'm not going to be critique Connor McDavid too much because without him, the Oilers wouldn't even like have been even close to this situation in a game 7 down one goal. He did everything he could. You know, the puck just didn't really bounce his way there at the end. But the Florida Panthers, you know, they were the best team in the playoffs. You know, they beat the Rangers, who were the best team in the regular season. They came out and won 3 straight games against the Oilers. I mean, the Oilers did come back, but the Panthers, you know, they were consistently the best team in this playoffs. And they were able to get the job done, winning their first Stanley Cup
in franchise history.
Very, very exciting for them. It was a great game 7. It came down to like literally the final seconds. Looked like though that in the last few minutes the Oilers, they kind of ran out of gas. Draisaitl, he wasn't really too big of a factor that much in the series, especially in game 7. You'd really want to see, you know, the number 2 of your 1-2 punch to make a bigger impact in the game. But I think the Oilers, you know, they were like 2-9 to start the season, clawed all the way back. Then they made this, you know, crazy run in the playoffs. They came back down 3-0, and I think in game 7, they just kind of ran out of gas, and especially after...
Yeah, it took so much effort to even get to that point that by then, they were just out, yeah.
Plus, they were playing Connor McDavid and Draisaitl. They were... their shift, they were playing so many minutes so much time on the ice in the third period. I think they just kind of ran out of gas there. And you could see with, like, you know, 40 seconds left, they weren't even, like... sprinting up the ice. So I think it was just kind of, they ran out of gas, but not taking anything away whatsoever from the Florida Panthers. Bobrovsky played an amazing game in goal to get them the victory. So Panthers, excellent performance in the playoffs. They did not blow the lead by one goal. But we were both one game off in our prediction of the Stanley Cup final.
6 games, yeah.
Yeah, we both said 6 exactly. games. So, but
we're close. Exciting. You were right too many times with the NBA, so you had to be nerfed somewhere.
Yeah, I did. It was the one game. They had to extend it that one more game. But I think the Oilers, very exciting team though, so I'm sure they'll be back.
Just to touch on a couple of things you said. Number one, like their team runs through Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl, but mainly Connor McDavid. So maybe I'm just a hater. You know, I shouldn't even criticize the guy. I mean, he was so good.
You're right, though. He had, like, if you're the, you know, you're the superstar, you're the LeBron James of your team, it's kind of like, you know, they're counting on him to score the goal. And, you know, he didn't get it done, but he was the best player. In Stanley Cup playoff history.
One of those things, like, I'm in between because I feel like star players get a lot of blame, but they also get a lot of excuses. And, like, I'm not saying he doesn't listen. If it wasn't for him, they probably wouldn't have even made the postseason.
Right. So but should he have scored? Should he have scored in that situation?
Yeah, he probably should have scored. I shouldn't be critiquing him. It's more like pointing out something like, or pointing out like an opportunity that the team missed.
Right.
Right. Like,
I completely agree. Completely agree.
The team runs through him. Like, I was more like joking that, like, you know, that he couldn't score that goal. He was great this whole postseason. And like we were saying, I don't know if they would even get there without his contributions, but They're an exciting team, and their team for the last few years and going forward is only going to go as far as he can carry them. Him and Draisaitl can carry them. So we'll see what they do next year. I think, you know, Stuart Skinner was pretty good in net for the most part. I think that was their main issue these few last few years, is that he did not have any goaltending. It's almost like Trout and Ohtani not having any pitching on their team. It's kind of a similar thing. People actually do. I mean, I've compared it and people said it's somewhat of a similar comparison, like Draisaitl and McDavid. At least they've actually made the postseason. But now that Skinner's there, maybe they, you know, or, you know, now that he's kind of solidifying himself, they should be a playoff team every single year. And I feel like when you have the best player, there's always a chance to get to the cup each and every year. But it was a very exciting game. I mean, like you said, they really, the last 5 minutes were so, was had so much action in it. And there were so many great saves. And it got me thinking of a question that I think we should answer. And that is, what is the hardest of all the four major sports? What do you think of all the championships, the Super Bowl, the World Series, the NBA Finals, and the Stanley Cup? Which one is the hardest to win? And which one do you think, Justin, is the most entertaining?
Ooh.
Yeah. So I want to hear your thoughts first.
That's,
and I'll say mine.
That's a loaded question. And I think based on your question, I'm gonna have a different answer for the first and the second question. I'm gonna have a different answer.
Well, enlighten us.
So I would say, so each of the four major sports, you know, they're their own like individual, they all have their own challenges, they have their own things that are a little bit easier, you know. Some sports you have to win less games to make the playoffs, or to less games in the playoffs to get to the finals. Others, you know, you have to win more, or there's more playoff teams. I would say of the four major sports, the toughest one, like holistically to win, this is including like, you know, the scheduling, the playoff format, the roster construction, like drafting, minor league system, everything that goes in to creating a championship team, from players to coaches to front office. I would go with baseball being the top.
I agree, but I want to hear your reasoning first. But I have my reasoning why it's the hardest.
First off, it's the longest. So it's, you have to be the best team. You have to play the most games. Now it is less taxing each game, individual game, on the body, and each game obviously means less, but you have to be, to make the playoffs, you have to be the best team for 162 games. Plus, out of the four major sports, the fewest amount of teams actually make the playoffs. So they play the longest season, but only 12 teams, six in each conference, make the playoffs. So that's already like very difficult. Plus, you know, you're mitigating injuries throughout the regular season. You have to have a lot of depth in your minor league system to be able to like win a lot of games. Cause no one, when it goes, you know, when it's October or late September, people aren't thinking about, oh, like how this guy from this great, you know, guy came up from AAA who got those big hits that stole us 3-4 wins in May. Like people aren't really thinking about that. But these are key in the MLB season. Plus you do all of that. You play 162 games. You have to build this infrastructure for your whole team. And then you make the playoffs. And if you're a wild card team, you only have three games your whole season. For over half the teams in the playoffs comes down to a three game series. And then it's a 5-7-7. So I think it's the most difficult. Also, everything in the playoffs, you know, every single pitch could be the difference between winning and losing any single game, which, you know, I'm not sure within every single like 20 seconds of a game that, like, you know, there's so much attention to detail. in any of the sports. So that's why I would say that's the hardest to win, because it's the hardest to build a sustained winner, because you have to build, you know, your lineup, and every single person in your lineup has like almost equal exposure. I mean, maybe guys at the top come up a couple extra times, but they have equal exposure. They have to come through, you know, every single person, every single person in your pitching staff throws has to be perfect, you know, or as good as humanly possible to try and like win a title. So that would be my answer to the first question. I don't know if you want to give your reasoning for baseball and then we go into the second one, or if you want me to go.
Sure.
You want to give your reasoning for baseball?
I agree with everything you said, but my reasoning has to do with more of with just like the sport and the series in general. I agree with everything you said. Baseball is the longest season. It's 162 games. It's a marathon. And like you said, one pitch could change everything. But that could also be true in other sports, like one throw in football, shot in basketball, one shot in hockey, one save. But anyway, here's why. Number one, like, I'm not even talking about hitting a baseball, because hitting a baseball is the hardest thing to do in sports. But here's why winning the World Series, I think, is the most difficult. Unlike the other four majors, the other three major sports, there's no clock in baseball. There is no, you cannot just sit on it and run the clock out and waste time. You have to get all 27 outs to win the game. There's no clock. So that's why I think baseball is the hardest championship to win, because we've seen it happen before, even in the best teams, when you have a comfortable lead. Even tonight, the Mets, which we'll get to in a few minutes, had a 9-1 lead that eventually became 9-7. Now, they did win the game, but there's no clock. The Mets had to get all 27 outs, which they did. So because of that, it enables teams to have this ability to come back, and it sort of makes the games more difficult, because the game's not over until you get that final out. There's no, okay, 2 minutes in football, let's just run the clock out and kneel.
Right.
No, you have to get every single out the same way. So that's why I think baseball, or this World Series, is the hardest championship to win.
I agree.
Not that any sport is easy. Every sport is
difficult. No, they all have their own challenges. Yeah. But I think the baseball, you need the most depth. I think you play, you know, you have to win the most games. And, you know, it's you have to get those 27 outs, as you said. Like, it's, you can be down 8-1 in the ninth inning, but you can't kneel it out. You have to
You can't just ease. You gotta get the last three hitters out. That's what I love about baseball. There is no clock. You have to get every out.
So so we agree on the first one. My second answer, which is the most exciting, would that be the most exciting championship game
most exciting series?
I would say football would be the most exciting. And my reasoning for that is that unlike the other three sports, it comes down to one game, whether, you know, the team and obviously, you know, there's the halftime show and there's all the buildup and everything. But I would say, you know, the NFL comes down to one game, whether or not, you know, you play the whole season, you train the entire year, and everything leads up to like one game or one drive, you know, to settle who wins, you know, the entire season. So I think just the excitement level of that one game and all of the excitement surrounding it, like, there's, I don't know if for any other like sport in almost in like the world, pretty much, on like a, you know, more of like a nat, not like a World Cup or anything, but like on a national type of sport where there's just so much, there's like nowhere where there's just so much excitement, as like there is in the Super Bowl, in the US. So there's just nothing like it. But the other, obviously there's, You know, the other series, you there's so much debate. They can go on for like 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and like battles back and forth. But I just think the excitement level of everything coming down to one game, there's just, in my head, there's just nothing that can beat it.
I love football, and I agree. It's very, they're all exciting.
Let's they get are.
That.
They are.
Let's but, first start with that. But what I will say is, in my opinion, the most exciting sporting event is a game seven in a hockey series. I don't think there's anything, or specifically game seven overtime in any hockey series, is the most entertaining form of sports there is. And I, you know me, I am a huge baseball guy. I'm a big football guy, and they're all exciting. Even like a game in a baseball playoff game in extra innings is exciting. But a game seven in hockey, especially last night, is such an entertaining sporting event, especially games that go to overtime, because the thing with hockey is the puck is so small and the shot is so fast that you don't even really, you don't see the puck go in until it's already over. So it's like you're biting your nails and you are losing your breath and you're biting your nails and you're so encapsulated on every single shot. And it's like, it takes so much. It's so stressful, but I love it. So that's why I think hockey, the Stanley Cup, is the most exciting, but it's specifically a game seven.
They're all really exciting.
They're all exciting.
It's but all all four of the team sports, soup, any games, you know, they're all really exciting, but can't go wrong with any of them.
Exactly. So I'm glad we answered that question with the Stanley Cup ending. So we both agree that baseball is the hardest to win. But you say football is the most exciting playoff game, and I say that hockey, specifically game seven, is the most exciting. They're all exciting though, and they all bring their own sort of unique charm and unique aspect that's exciting to it. So now we'll talk, in the last 10, 15 minutes here, about a little bit of baseball. So the first thing we'll talk about is the New York Mets, who are one of, if not the hottest team in baseball right now, which if you go back to episode one or two, it was the opposite. They were down in the dumps. They were in the cellar. They were losing so many games that they were blowing so many games. I think the first episode I talked about how I was at the game, they blew a 6-2 lead, and that was rock bottom. Then they had the Jorge Lopez incident, and then since the Jorge Lopez incident, they've been one of the hottest teams in baseball. The offense has been on fire, and they're just finding ways to win games. The bullpen is still a concern, though. And today, like I said, we're up 9-1. We'll talk about the Yankees in a minute, but today starts the Subway Series. It's a big series. And even though this series doesn't have any implications in the standings, because if the Mets were to win two or lose two to the Yankees, they already won one. So even if they lose tomorrow, there's no standings implications with the Yankees, but it's bigger than that. I mean, you know, the Subway Series is the implications are not in, they're not tangible. They're not in the standings, but it's a bragging rights thing. And it feels good to beat the Yankees, but today they come in, their Mets are hot. The Yankees are faltering. They have lost 6 of 8. Gerrit Cole is making his second start of the season, and he was not good at all. He did not look like the Gerrit Cole that I know. Gerrit Cole won the Cy Young last year. He has been one of the most reliable, durable starting pitchers in baseball. Before this year, I don't know if he'd ever been on the injured list before. He had been top six in Cy Young voting for 5 of the last 6 seasons. He is one of the best pitchers in baseball. He's probably going to be a Hall of Famer. And today, he was all over the place. He could not locate his fastball. His velocity was down. He wasn't throwing his slider. He was throwing a lot of cutters, and he just didn't seem like he was confident in his pitches. And because of that, the Mets jumped all over him. They hit 4 home runs. Mark Vientos hit 2. And, you know, he's turning out to be a surprise, because from what I remember, everyone called him a quadruple A player before the season started. Now he could still turn into that because it's only been like 2 months, but I like what I see. Brandon Nimmo, who's been hotter than how the weather has been here in New Jersey the last week, he hit another home run. He has 5 in the last 7 games. And who else hit a home run today? Who was the other one? Harrison Bader, the former Yankee, hit a home run. So he gave up 7 hits, Cole, in 4 innings today. 7 hits, 6 runs, 4 homers, and one of the ones really weird, no strikeouts. It was the first, it was only the second start in his career. He's made 302 starts, only the second time he'd ever had a start where he did not strike out a single batter. So something's obviously wrong with him. I'm not making excuses for him. The Mets, rightfully so, were crushing the ball off him today, but something isn't right. I don't know if he's still injured. I don't know if they rushed him back, but something is clearly wrong. But anyway, the Mets were up 9-1, and the Yankees get a run in the sixth inning. Then the seventh inning, the eighth inning comes along, and with the bases loaded and a run already in at 9-3, Reed Garrett comes in, and on an 0-2 pitch, throws a fastball right down the middle. Why, against Aaron Judge, you're up 0-2, why would you throw him a fast? Why would you throw a strike? Justin, let me tell you something. And for all those listening, I want you to listen to me carefully. The two worst things you can do as a pitcher, these are the two unforgivable things you can do as a pitcher. Walk the leadoff hitter of an inning and give up a hit, let alone a home run, on an 0-2 pitch. That should never happen. That is a fireable offense. Not fireable, but that is unforgivable in my book. You are 0-2. Why do you throw a strike? And this is to Aaron Judge. So he hits a whole grand slam. Now it's 9-7. The Mets did Reed Garrett came back and pitched this clean ninth inning. So it's fine. So the bullpen is a concern. Now you're asking, why was Reed Garrett in the ninth inning in a 2-run game? Well, why is the bullpen still a concern? Because the Mets closer Edwin Diaz, who just came off the injured list, is suspended. The Mets were in Chicago over the weekend. Sunday's game, they have a 5-2 lead. Edwin Diaz is coming in to get the save. I change the channel for 1 minute. I come back, and Edwin Diaz is ejected. And he's walking off the field. So I said, what happened? So I go back, and I find out that the umpire felt his hand, which they do with every pitcher. This is a new thing they started doing in 2021 where, that was kind of back when – I remember we actually had an episode about it back when we had the old podcast where we talked about Gerrit Cole, of all people, was using the spider tack, and they were cracking down on substances. And they started implementing the checks where the umpires would check the pitcher's glove and their hand, see if it was sticky. Now it was pretty restrictive and pretty strict the first couple of years, but the last couple of years it's been pretty lax and pretty lenient, and there really haven't been any suspensions. But all of a sudden, Vic Carapazzo feels Edwin Diaz's hand and he thinks it's too sticky and he throws him out. Now, what's really annoying about this is there's an automatic 10-game suspension when you get ejected for substances. Now, I understand why, because they want to abolish the substances, the sticky stuff. So I understand why there's such a severe punishment. But tell me if I'm wrong, Justin. I feel like that's something very subjective. Like, how sticky someone's hand is really up to the umpire's discretion. One umpire might say, oh, that's fine. But another umpire might think it's too sticky. Now, I guess there's like a general rule, but there needs to be more defined criteria for this, because how much rosin is too much rosin? How much pelican wax or whatever they're using is too much? So I feel like it's too subjective for it to be this harsh of a penalty. And now the Mets are kind of screwed, because not only is he suspended for 10 games, but you can't replace the guy on the roster. So the Mets only have 25 roster spots. Now they're short a bullpen arm. And they're gonna about to, after the Yankee series, play 17 games in a row without an off day.
Well, I mean, I guess I'll start with the Edwin Diaz part. Well, it is subjective, but a lot of things in baseball are subjective until they implement robot umpires. The strike zone is very subjective, even though they're supposed to be a correct box. But I mean, I saw like pictures of what his hand looked like, and there was clearly stuff on his cover. His hands were covered in substances. So I do think he did have substances. I mean, were other umpires, did they allow it? I mean, that I don't know. And obviously, like, me, you know, I don't know what the exact passable level that the umpires are like instructed to allow. But if they felt that Edwin Diaz had too much, and I saw the pictures of it, he clearly had substances on his hands, then, you know, there's nothing more you can do. Edwin Diaz, he said that he's not going to change his routine and how much stuff that he's using. If that is the case, does he come back and his first game back or second game back get suspended again? I mean, that I don't know. Or is he just saying that and he's going to start using left stuff? The other question that, you know, the part you don't really want to think about is, did Edwin Diaz start using more stuff because he hasn't been pitching as well and was trying to find a way, you know, to improve his game and start pitching better? It's another that's another angle to it. Which of any of these circumstances it is, whether, you know, it's just a one-off and he was accidentally put a little too much on, whether he was trying to gain a competitive advantage, whether the umpire was just a little too strict, kind of impossible to know. But, you know, it kind of is what it is. That's kind of how baseball is. And I guess at least for the Mets' sake and for Edwin Diaz's sake, it takes place in end of June for start of July rather than in September. Talk about the Mets, though. I said in, you know, when we were talking April and May that, you know, it's not over just yet. Teams can get hot. I mean, it's they almost kind of remind you of the Nationals team when they were one of the worst teams, then all of a sudden rallied to go win the World Series. When the Phillies, they were, you know, the laughing stock of the league, fired Joe Girardi, were 22-29. They went on to go to the World Series. So you're never out of it. A lot of times it's whoever's hot, you know, the hottest team at the end of the season. So it's exciting for New York baseball that the Mets are back in it. And well, let's, you know, we can see if they can keep it going. If they do keep it going, they're right in the race, then you can make some trades at the deadline for relievers and really bulk up the team to go for the wild card. Or, you know, if the Phillies or Braves start to, you know, lose some games, maybe you can even get back into the division race, with a lot of division games left to play against those two teams for the Mets.
Yeah, you're right. We won't know. Like, I feel like it's probably more likely that he put a little bit too much on that day, because I feel like,
yeah,
around the league, like, I know there's no set limit, but like they all sort of know what to look for. So I feel like if he had been using substances, this would have been an issue before. But what I don't get is there have been situations where the pitcher will go out, the umpire feels their hand and they think it's sticky, and then they were allowed to go wash their hands. Clark Schmidt on the Yankees was allowed to go like clean his hand off. I think that's what should happen. I think if you're the pitcher or you're the umpire, say, okay, listen, your hand's a little sticky, wipe it off, go wash your hand, I'll check it again, and then you should be back. But like, I understand, but I know you might say, like, then what's the point of the rule? But then why did they let him go wash his hands then? Why did they let that happen?
That I don't know, but if they did that, then every pitcher is just going to douse their hands and stuff and then hope that the umpire doesn't make them go wash their hands. So
yeah, no,
I understand the 10-game suspension rule. It's unfortunate that it's a subjective, but I assume that there's been, I would hope that there's been some, you know, instruction to the pitchers and to the umpires on, you know, the tolerable levels, examples of what's what it's supposed to be. But with every umpire, you know, any given day, just like the strike zone, they can change their mind on what they think is a tolerable level or inning to inning. So, well, but I think the most interesting thing to me about this Edwin Diaz situation will be to see if he gets another suspension at some point this season, if he really is just
sure, going to. I don't know if anyone's ever been suspended twice for this.
That's the thing that, like, if, is he going to get this? Or if, when I know he was pitching a little bit better since he came back, if maybe, if, you know, if he starts pitching worse again, these are just things to look for. Could be more speculation than anything and kind of just like an accident. But we'll see what happens with it.
I hope it was an accident, but I will say there have been 9 players since this rule was implemented that have been suspended. 3 of them have been on the Mets. Max Scherzer, Drew Smith last year, and Edwin Diaz this year. So I don't know if Jeremy Hefner, the Mets pitching coach, is just not like monitoring this, or if the league has something against the Mets. I don't know.
I'm sure it's just a coincidence.
No, it is a coincidence.
It's not like, just because Edwin Diaz got suspended, that doesn't mean he's a dirty player or anything like.
No, not at all.
It's like, it's just kind of like, now if he gets suspended again, then it's like, okay, what's going on? But like, it's very, that type of thing's very different from like if he were suspended for using like performance enhancing drugs.
Well, if he gets suspended again, like that raises a lot of other questions. But I think literally was just like, he just had a little bit too much this time.
I think the other interesting thing you brought up about the New York Yankees, that you know, they haven't been playing very well of late. Like, they lost like 7 of their last 9.
They have.
I think that just goes to show that they're very dependent on the performance of Aaron Judge and Juan Soto. And if either one of those two guys is either not in the lineup or, you know, not performing at an MVP level, they're susceptible to losing games. I mean, in Juan Soto's last 7 games, he's batting 182. And in his last 15 games, he's batting 227. So, if one, you know, one of their two superstars is not hitting, and you know, they're not getting spectacular pitching, it just shows the, you know, some sort of weakness on their roster. But I'm not too concerned about the Yankees. They still have a very complete team, and they still have one of the best starting pitching staffs, in my opinion, in major. Not the best, but one of the best in baseball. So they're still a very good team. So if I were the Yankees, wouldn't be like going full panic just yet.
No, they shouldn't be. But actually, Judge and Soto have still been performing. I mean, Soto hit a home run today. Judge hit a home run today. Judge had 5 RBIs. So it's not even like if they're not performing, it's more like the two of them have done their part. They need to find other.
They do.
Other guys have to step up, because Anthony Volpe's been good this year, but he's been kind of cold recently. Stanton's on the injured list, which is a huge deal. Rizzo's been injured. JD Davis, they just signed him off the street. And also, Gerrit Cole does not look like the guy that he was. And the problem is, Luis Gil got roughed up his last start, and he's reaching an innings limit. Their starting pitching has been good. Carlos Rodon has looked pretty bad in his last couple starts. So, like, there are weaknesses on this team, but there are weaknesses that I think you can address at the trade deadline. They're still a very good team. They're going to win 100 games. I'm not worried. It's just interesting to note out that Cole did not look like himself today. I think that's the biggest issue right now.
Well, I completely agree. They need other guys to step up, but I agree. But they have, in large part, have been winning just because they have like probably the 2 best hitters in the entire American League on their team. But similar to like, but they do need other guys like Stanton. They need Volpe. They need Rizzo, all these other guys to step up as well. I wouldn't put too much stock into the Gerrit Cole performance yet. He's just coming back from a very long layoff from an elbow injury. I think the most important thing is that he feels fine after his start. Like, if he still feels healthy, I think that it's going. I just think you know, you can't, it's very difficult to just come back after missing half the season and your first performance to go like seven shutout innings. So I'm not too worried about Gerrit Cole just yet, as long as he's still feeling healthy. Now, if he's not, if it's a month from now and we're talking about Gerrit Cole with a 7 ERA or something like that, then maybe my panic meter would go up a bit. But after one start, I'm not going to put too much stock into it.
Yeah, I agree. The Yankees will be fine. I think Cole will be fine. I think it just takes a couple starts. I'm sure in a month we'll be talking about how he's had four great starts in a row after tonight. But I guess just for some final thoughts here, one thing I want to mention that's really interesting, there was the first ever walk-off pitch clock violation.
I saw.
The Nats were playing the Rockies, and the Rockies had the bases loaded with, like, nobody out. And Kyle Finnegan, it was a 3-1 count, and Kyle Finnegan on the mound took too long. So an automatic ball was called, and the Rockies won. So I just wanted to mention that. I think that's kind of funny. We've always said, like, I'm actually surprised it took this long. It took like a year and a half for that to happen. I just want to ask final thoughts. Like, do you like the pitch clock? I was against it originally. Now I love it. I think it's great. I think the game is so much quicker. And like back in the day, like 20, 30 years ago, the game would go this quickly. I don't know why recently it began taking begun to take so long, but I think it's been really nice, the pace of play, and I don't really think it's affected like the pitchers too much. I think there's been a few violations here and there, but for the most part, I think they're pretty on time with it, the hitters and the pitchers.
Yeah, I think like pitchers are starting, like, obviously there's like been the injury speculation around it, but I think pitchers are starting, as you know, this year and as you know a couple more years go by, it's just going to be, you know, a regular thing, like that there always was the pitch clock type of thing, and right, it won't really be thought of that much. I think players are getting more used to it, I think I'm starting to like it more. I think when they first implemented it and there was like a lot of complaints and all these comparisons about how it was messing up the game, you know, it skewed the opinions towards the negative route. I don't really have any issue with it. I think it's good that they're speeding up the game some, and like it's kind of like having in the NFL how they have the play clock. Like you have to, like,
it's keeping the pace of play.
Yeah, it's like keeping the pace of play. Now, do they, you know, does it need, I know they like reduce the amount of time for this year. Like, I'm not sure they need to keep reducing the amount of time. Maybe in the ninth, they could, like, in the ninth inning, they could increase the amount of time.
I think in the playoffs, they should, like, in the ninth inning, there shouldn't be a clock. Or, I think they should take it away in the ninth inning.
Yeah, like, I think there's some I think maybe, like, I think they might, where, I mean, we could talk about it for a while, like, the exact ruling of how, but I think maybe like for the ninth inning it should be a little bit of a longer clock, and I think in the playoffs it should be, I definitely think they should have a longer clock, as there's like, you know, so much pressure in all these situations. But overall I think it's good that they're like the pace of play is a little bit quicker, and you know, it'll keep more fan engagement, so anything that they're able to get more fans and grow the game I think is a good thing.
Yeah, and the ratings have been up since they've implemented it. But yeah, I agree. Just I think in the playoffs, they should either make it longer or they should have no pitch clock in the ninth inning. And I think the only thing they did was they reduced. So the pitch clock with nobody on base has always been 15 seconds. But with men on base, it was 20 seconds last year. They reduced it to 18. I think they could have kept that at.
Yeah.
I think honestly, they should have kept that at 20 and made the clock with nobody on base like, I think they could leave that at 50. I think it was fine the way it was last year.
Like, is that really going to make that much of a difference? Like,
the 2 seconds doesn't really matter.
Right. But it could matter for the pitcher.
I guess.
But it's subjective and it's so dependent. The one pitcher that consistently cannot get pitches off before the pitch clock is Craig Kimbrel, for the Orioles closer. He is still having a lot of issues with the pitch clock. So
it was Kyle Finnegan, the guy that gave up the walk-off.
Yeah,
he leads the league in pitch clock violations. I don't, maybe they, listen, like, some guys are slow workers, but like, you got to work on that, man. Like, you got to,
but that's an easy thing
figure
to
that out.
The
yeah
thing is, that's an easy, you can, the pitcher can see the pitch clock, so like they should know
yeah
when like the clock's ticking down, then that should be built into their routine in the off season. So, but I guess we'll see as some of the, I think as the game moves on, they had this pitch clock in the minor leagues for years before they had it in the majors. So as older players retire and as newer younger players
that are used to it, that came up.
Yeah. It's going,
yeah, I think I agree with that. That'll make it easier for the transition. Eventually we won't even notice that it's there.
Right.
Already feeling that way. But anyway, great episode. And I think that's going to do it for us today on Penn Station Sports Talk. Justin, do you have anything else to add?
No, I'm excited for our next episode. Hopefully there's a lot of good Knicks news for us to talk about, and you know, maybe they make some other big trades for some other stars. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, next week we'll talk about the NBA draft and free agency and any trades. And then we'll also be doing our, I know I said we were going to do it this week, but next week we will be doing our midseason award picks for Major League Baseball close to the trade deadline. I mean, close to the All-Star break. So looking forward to that. But until then, we hope you all enjoyed this episode of Penn Station Sports Talk. Don't forget to download and subscribe so that you never miss another episode of Penn Station Sports Talk. Thank you all so much for listening.